I'm Kevin Panton. I'm interviewing David Shaler and King Arthur Pendragon. We are at the Sunrise Festival. So, first off, are you enjoying the Sunrise Festival, David?
Absolutely, yes. I came down here to give a talk on Friday night, and I'm still here on, I think it's Tuesday today, isn't it? I think. So I've got to be the most ill-prepared person here. All I've got is like a tent and a duvet and a little mattress and the clothes I'm standing in. But everyone's been fabulous. It's been great.
And Arthur, you enjoying yourself at the Sunrise?
Yeah, I'm having a good time. I'm between gigs, as it were. I've been doing a ritual up in London, going on from here to Stonehenge to do another one, then on to Avebury. And I'm a bit more prepared. I knew I was coming here, but I'm living on a motorbike at the moment.
Similarly basic. Okay, David Shaler, if you don't know, is an ex-MI5 agent who famously blew the whistle on incompetency and questionable morals in the Secret Service. Arthur, King Arthur Pendragon, frequent candidate for Member of Parliament for Winchester, and what is your official title at the Loyal Arthurian Warband?
Well, I'm titular head and chosen chief of the Loyal Arthurian Warband, which is a Druid order. I'm head of that order, but I am also the battle chieftain of the Council of British Druid Orders. So, basically, I'm a druid that kicks ass.
We like it.
You can both hold the mic a tad close, please.
Yeah. No, okay. And one thing they both share in common is that they were both imprisoned, both, in my opinion, for their morals and their beliefs. Dave, first off, why were you imprisoned? What was the conviction?
I was actually convicted under the 1989 Official Secrets Act, and all I had to prove, basically, was that I talked about MI5 without their permission. And since I had they had a newspaper with me writing articles and things like that, that was pretty easy to prove. And it was made even worse because the judge said to the jury, if you find this man guilty on the facts, you must convict him. When, of course, in English law, there is an option of acquitting on the grounds of justice. So I wasn't even given that option either. And I went to Belmarsh, a maximum security prison, basically.
Right. And what was it that you were actually writing about MI5 that they weren't happy with, that they sought to convict you for?
A whole load of things, but the thing that obviously upset them the most was me talking or blowing the whistle on MI6 funding Al-Qaeda in 1996. You know, I find it absolutely unbelievable that they've managed to get away with funding our terrorist enemies when you've got somebody who's willing to be a witness who writes to government ministers and writes to MPs and tries to get people to ask questions, uses the kind of rules of democracy, and gets absolutely nowhere. I mean, this is not some allegation about not filling in a warrant. This is about killing innocent people in an operation conducted without the permission of the government. So it's illegal in this country as well. You know, these guys really do think they're James Bond with a license to kill. Well, in fact, they are, because they have a license to kill, but only if they've got permission of the Foreign Office.
Well, and getting permission from the Foreign Office, is that an easy thing to do for an agent?
Well, I don't think they do it. I just don't think they bother with that process. So they just keep the ministers in the dark, so then they can deny it, and the minister can say, well, yeah, it's not going on because we didn't give permission for it.
So they're pretty much unaccountable.
Oh, totally, yes. I mean, they don't think they run the country. They do run the country.
Right.
And I think a lot of people out there have got to understand that if you want to change this country, you've got to change the people who protect those in power. And that comes from the intelligence services and the secrecy they work in, the way they use that to create fear and paranoia, or actually to carry out attacks on people as they did in 9/11.
Okay, and Arthur, I think it would be fair to describe you as the man dressed as a medieval king at road protests and at Stonehenge and Avebury on the equinoxes and solstices, and possibly the man largely responsible for everybody being legally permitted to enter the stones at Stonehenge. So the question's the same, why were you imprisoned?
I've been in prison a number of times, normally merely on remand, and for some of the most irreverent legislation that you can think of, trespassing, because up until a certain point in time, trespassing was a civil matter and not a criminal offence. But since the Thatcher days and the Criminal Justice Bill, even before it became an act, it was quite clear that it was making a criminal offence out of trespassory assembly and also out of aggravated trespass. And I challenged it and was charged under both. In fact, I believe I was the first ever to be charged for unlawful assembly under the trespassing assembly laws, and also the first to get off in Salisbury Magistrates Court, and this was over Stonehenge. I was found not guilty on that. Aggravated trespass, I've been prosecuted a number of times basically for being up a tree and saying to court bailiffs, no, you cannot chop this tree down because I'm here to protect the environment. But as I've said, I've never had a criminal conviction that has resulted in a prison sentence. So most of the time that I've spent in prison, and I too was in Belmarsh, most of the time that I've spent in prison has been on remand. And unfortunately for me, although the law quite clearly states that you can wear your own clothes in prison as a remand prisoner, they've decided that my robes, which are in fact druidic robes, are not suitable in prison. So I've been forced, or they've tried to force me, to wear prison uniform. I've refused as a remand prisoner and spent most of my time naked on the block in segregation. And I've spent months and months in jail when you add it all up, and I've never actually had a sentence. It's merely been, in my opinion, expedient to get me out of the way, knowing damn well I wouldn't accept their clandestine bail conditions, which they would offer me. In other words, yes, you're a remand prisoner, it's only a minor offence, but actually you've got to agree. And one of the people, for instance, on the Newbury bypass actually agreed not to go south of the M4, right? So they think they're sheriffs and it's the Wild West and they can run us out of town. Well, I've got news for them, they can't.
Are we supposed to have civil liberties? Are we told?
We are supposed to have civil liberties. They are being eroded daily as we speak.
Indeed, indeed. So why, sorry, why did you seek to trespass? What was, why was, why did you feel it was, moral for you to...
It was moral for me to trespass, which used to be a civil offence. It's the Thatcher's government that made it into a criminal offence. And trespassing is sitting up a tree when someone's coming to cut it down because it's not my tree, although it's my planet, and that tree has as much right on this planet as I do, and I have as much right to sit up that tree as they have to chop it down.
Okay, so you were both imprisoned for standing by your beliefs, or speaking for your beliefs in your case, David. I admire you both because you stood up for what you believe in, and specifically when you were alone. What is it like? First, Dave, now you have the 9/11 movement, and a lot of people are questioning the acts and the moral procedures even of the secret services. What is it like having a team behind you now?
Well, that's made all the difference in my life. I mean, I have recently been through a kind of spiritual awakening, which really saved me, because I got to the point where, you know, what I started to do, I'd done for good reasons, but because of the way I'd been treated, I was angry with them, and I thought there'd been attempts on my life in you know, being car crashes and so on. So I lived in absolute fear. And when you're an atheist, if you have nothing else, the idea of death is totally daunting. But I've always been very lucky because I've been supported by my partner Annie, who's been absolutely brilliant through this whole process. I mean, she also worked for MI5, so she knew what I was talking about. She's able to go out and talk as convincingly as me about this. But this is what they've got to realise now, is there is now a big movement. A lot more people have heard of me and my case and so on. And they're going to take me to court again. They're taking me to court very soon to sue me for breach of copyright and breach of confidence, basically. And they want to get a lot of money off me, but that's not going to make a blind bit of difference, because I haven't got anything. I don't own anything. So they can award £100,000. I don't really care. But, you know, this gives us a great opportunity. Although they, you know, they think they're trying to persecute me with this, I just think now, well, what a great opportunity for it all. Go down there, have a little sing-song and everything, you know. Whatever it takes, get the placards on the telly, get the placards in the paper. And then suddenly the 9/11 logo will become emblazoned in everybody's minds, and people will hopefully start questioning the 9/11 issue, because that's the one, you know, that's the one we've got to get across to people. That opens up the doors to a whole lot of other issues.
Okay, Arthur, we mentioned the protests at the road protest and the standing up for the trees. You were also stood up for our rights to enter Stonehenge. A lot of that was on your own before you had the Loyal Arthurian Warband. What is it like, the comparison in a...
There's really no comparison. I spent 14 years, year in, year specifically getting arrested and thrown in the cells for a night. I'd done that knowing what I was doing to challenge the system. I was saying that their laws were unjust and I had as much right to walk down the Queen's Highway as anybody else. They were saying that there was a 5 mile exclusion zone in and around Stonehenge over a 3 day period over the solstice. I said that was illegal, eventually got it heard in the European court.
How did you manage to get it heard in the European court?
By having a number of solicitors who would listen to me and would do it on a no win, no fee basis. But of course, that hadn't even been invented then. But by getting the support, and I actually had support from Liberty and a number of other influential groups, it was merely harder for me in the beginning. You asked me what the comparison is, and there isn't one. I mean, in the beginning, it was just me pissing in the wind. It was just me saying, this is wrong, let's do something about it. And by the time I finished, 14 years later, I dragged the Druids into the battle, I dragged the Pagans into the battle, I dragged everybody into the battle, just as I dragged them up the trees on a protest site, because that's what I do. I'm a battle chieftain. And it's a lot better when you've an army at your disposal than it is when you're an individual. But it didn't matter. I was going to do it anyway, whether anybody followed or anything. Because if I've got a motto when it comes to taking on the authorities, or when it comes to taking on anything, it's quite simple: lead, follow, or get out the fucking way.
Can I say, I do agree with that actually as well, and I have the same feeling. I did it, you know, just thinking I'm going to do this because it's got to be challenged. You don't know whether people are going to follow or not, or whether people are going to take a buying bit of interest. But you do find just the very act of standing up for the truth. There are a lot of people out there, you know, who are, you know, read the mainstream media and so on, but they can see through the lies and everything. They can spot people who are doing something that's making a contribution to humanity rather than doing it for big business or whatever. So this day and age, people can see this, but even though the mainstream media often malign us or take the piss out of us, that in some ways just makes us more popular.
Quite. I do apologise for the sound interference, but I might be paranoid, but it does seem like they have black helicopters flying over the Sunrise Festival. Indeed.
It's Dave's people. You know. They're wondering what we're doing in here.
Indeed,
no,
indeed.
No, I didn't tell you about the aerial arm at all. I thought it more bad, did I? And we've got a name. A couple of coracles.
Well, just before I move on to the next question, I think that a lot of people will follow solely because you had the courage to stand up for yourself or stand up for your beliefs while you were alone, and that in itself is admirable. So on a completely different note, what was the funniest thing about prison?
There was nothing funny about Belmarsh, I don't think. It was it was okay, because I mean, you go in there and because you're a bit of a slev, always running about you in the Sun, because they all read the Sun basically, and even though the Sun called me a traitor, they all said, well, fuck it, you know, we know you're not, basically anyone who gives it to them, you're on our side. But then there's the odd element, of course, of people who are nutters, you know, and basically they just want to have a go at you because you are the slev. They want to get in the papers as the person that, you know, attacked David Shaler. So that makes your time there extremely scary, because there's nowhere you can go. You know, you're locked in these bloody cells and things with people 23 hours a day or whatever. So there wasn't anything. I'm trying to think of anything to really laugh about in Belmarsh. But I remember normally, I suppose, in life you keep your sense of humour. That's one of the things you've got to do. If you can't laugh at things, you know, you are finished. So I suppose when I was there, I did laugh, but I can't think of any particularly funny incidents about Belmarsh. It was more the idea, the memories are more the kind of things like some guy trying to beat me up and seeing a guy getting slashed with a kind of modified razor. And
well, I was going to ask what's the worst thing about prison, but let's not go there. No, it's quite dark. I'm having a lovely time.
The worst thing about prison is you lose your liberty. That is the worst thing about prison. The fact that when that cell door shuts, you are no longer determining your own destiny.
I disagree, because the best thing about prison is I am determining my destiny. I'm only in there because I bloody want to be. I'm only in there because it's me taking them on. And unlike yourself, who is in there because they wanted you in there. They didn't want me in prison. They didn't want protesters in prison. They were even, Michael Howard at the time, when the Newbury bypass protest was going on, was talking about bringing in prison ships for all the pagan influx, because we wanted to be there. We wanted to make a stand. We wanted to stand and be counted. And personally, I've had lots of fun experiences in prison. I find them great. They think I'm playing their game. No, they're playing mine, or I wouldn't have got nicked and I wouldn't have been in a court in the first place because they were playing at my plan. They just didn't realise that yet.
Quite, yeah. Both had very different experiences in prison. I think it's that question, well, the funniest thing in prison, well, Dave didn't spend half his time in prison naked, so it's... do you feel justified and rewarded for your hardships, David? I mean, was it worth it?
Absolutely, yes. No, I mean, I don't think you can do anything else in that situation. You've got to speak out about something like that. And all the things I've been through have been a test, and I think I've come through that test. I'm still here. I'm now. I'm laughing. I'm having a good time. And that's the worst thing you can do. That's what they don't want. They want you to crack up. They want you to just look like your life's falling apart and things like that. And if you don't go down that route, they hate it.
Right.
And that's me. I've been through a result of this. I've been through a spiritual conversion that I don't think I'd ever would have gone through otherwise. You know, I was a person who was a total rationalist, alienist, atheist, pragmatist, or whatever. You know. And to change like this in 18 months has been an enormous spiritual awakening. And to the extent, you know, I fully believe now that you can determine the way the world works just by positive thought and love, basically. So I was thinking about writing to Tony Blair and saying, thanks, Tony. Thanks for giving me this opportunity to make me a better person. please, Tony. And I mean this absolutely seriously, Tony. I'd love to meet you and I'd love to have a conversation with you. In fact, I'd like to actually give you the evidence you've never actually taken about MI6 funding Al-Qaeda as well, but but I really would like to open your eyes.
Either that, or if you buy into it, he's gone deeper undercover.
Yes, indeed. Who's interviewing who, eh? Like, quite. For all we know, those black helicopters might not be quite as pissed off about you being sacked with a bunch of hippies skinning up and drinking mead as we think they might be, but it's all right, Dave, I love you. And I can't imagine them actually managing to train one of the other MI5 to say something on the words of a positive thought and love quite as convincingly as you just did.
No, I don't think so. I do have my story about Kabbalah and football as well. I'd say that.
I might get to that. There are questions on spiritual revelations coming, but after the discussion about Kabbalistic positive thought getting Middlesbrough to the final, I'm not sure the public's ready for that, but we'll see. And do you get frustrated at some of the public naivety of 9/11, yet still after all the things that have been shown, the videos, the movement to expose it, does it frustrate you?
I'm not frustrated by the people's reaction, because all you've got to do is get a couple of DVDs in front of people and they will very quickly come round to at least thinking that there are questions to be asked, if not going the full yard and saying it's the inside job. The frustration is with Parliament and the media. People who should be doing this job, who should be doing these investigations, aren't doing it. It's up to people like us, you know, people who, through our own talent and initiative, get these things done. I mean, as we know, we're producing a 9/11 documentary, a 7/7 documentary, and this is, again, a thing about faith. The creator will provide. We've produced these documentaries that I think could be shown on Panorama. You know, £200,000 documentaries, that's what they look like. We've made them on nothing because we just seem to get access to lights and camera when we need them.
And this built is, on share, yeah, love and creativity.
And we've evened up the playing field. For so many years, only big business or the BBC could produce television and documentaries and stuff like that. Now we can do it in our bedrooms. That changes the rules again. It's an even playing field if we can produce things and get them in front of people.
Indeed. Just with a bit of hardship and a bit of creativity, you can conduct an interview from a festival in your back of your car. And Arthur, do you feel justified and rewarded for your hardships? Was it worth it again?
I felt I had no choice. I was faced with a choice some years ago, 20 years ago now, 1986. I was faced with the choice: if you really think you're a druid, you really think you're a druid leader, you really think you can make a difference, give it a go. If you don't, just sit on your ass and do nothing. Well, the only epitaph I want is no regret. So I went for it and I've never looked back since.
Better play it. And I think, well, if the question you asked yourself was if you succeed... Well, go for it, and if you succeed, you succeed. Well, success. We're allowed in Stonehenge now. There's a success.
Well, that's a success. But I mean, success wasn't about or wasn't important. belief was always important to me, and my belief structure told me I had a path that was laid out for me. I could either do it or not do it. It never occurred to me, well, I'll do it so long as it works and it's successful, but I won't do it if it goes wrong. I mean, it just happens. The success is a byproduct. It happens that I've been successful along the way, but I'd still be doing it. One of the things I did do was become a complete renunciate. I don't sign on. I claim no state benefit whatsoever. And in my opinion, if I was going to do it right, if it was going to work, then the magic would sustain me. The goddess would provide. I mean, other people would say, well, yeah, that just means you've got a lot of good mates who looked after you along the way. But they're two sides of the very same coin.
Indeed.
Because if I didn't have those mates, if those mates thought, who is this nutter? What's he doing? And, you know, obviously I've managed to convince some people to believe in me. So success is a byproduct. I'm not bothered about that. All I'm bothered about is at the end of the day, when I go to sleep, I can justify myself to myself, and that's all that matters. And I couldn't have done that if I hadn't have at least tried.
Indeed. And the love you receive at things such as the Sunrise Festivals, does that make things worth it when you're in the pub in Avebury and people know who you are and what you've done for them? Does that make a difference?
It makes it more comfortable. It doesn't really make it any easier, because I'd still be doing it whether they were there or not. It's just that more and more people over the years have got to know me and what I'm about. But that didn't stop me doing it 20 years ago. And even whatever happens in the next 20 years, I'm still going to be doing it. And it's a life quest for me. And that's fighting for truth, honour and justice.
And David, when you're in the SE1 club at a psychedelic trance party and they're having a very eclectic evening with talks with ex-MI5 agents and physicists, etc., there's the love you receive at places like that, people actually just telling you thank you for actually exposing things, does that make a difference?
Yeah, it does make an enormous difference, it really does. I mean, I've been so touched by the number of people who've come up to me and said, you know, thank you for doing this, you know. And that makes all the difference. It does. It really does. And you can keep yourself going that way. And that's what kept me going. You say when the chips were really down, there were still people, even then, when I was approaching the court case and everything like that, coming up to me in the street and saying, well done, mate, you know. And I have the odd person who has a go at me. And I think some of those have been sent in by, you know, the forces of darkness, basically the intelligence services, just to try and destabilise me or whatever. I had a go, like the other day, having a go at me on the tube and things, you know. But you know that's the kind of game they play. I think any honest person can just look at my case and see very quickly that you don't go through 8 or 9 years of something like this unless you believe in what you're doing. It's what you're saying, Arthur.
And so, what is your relationships with the police now after your various encounters?
Well, the funny thing about the police is, obviously, when I was in MI5, I worked very closely with the police, and I think a lot of people don't understand what the police are like in general. The police, who are, you know, the foot soldiers, ordinary people, you know. It's the actual people at the top who are forcing them to do terrible things and the ones who turn a blind eye to, you know, beating people up and so on that create the problems. But, you know, I work with the police against terrorists and we all, I think, work quite honourably together. We were stopping people putting bombs down, you know. And it was interesting that after I'd been convicted, the police made a point, Special Branch made a point of coming to meet me to give him my passport back, which I'd surrendered for bail. And they said, we wanted nothing to do with this prosecution. They've just told, they've told a load of lies about the Official Secrets Act, and we want you to know that. And I've actually since then, as a result of that, been able to get back to those guys and say, you know, when I've thought there have been attempts on my life, I've actually informed the police. I've just thought, you know, they can't stop anybody, but I'm going to put this on record somewhere. So you've got to have relationships with people. You've got to find the good people in any organisation, basically.
That's touching. And you, Arthur, what's your relationship with the police after your various encounters?
My relationship with the police is very good, but very strange. I mean, I've been arrested some like 39 times, but I've never been arrested once with malice. It's always been, come on, Arthur, you know the score. You step one more step over this line or you refuse to leave, you're arrested. But it's always been, let's argue it in court. I would say that some of my colleagues and some of my best friends are coppers, because I know a lot of them.
Is it cool being ex-MI5?
Cool being ex-MI5, yes. It's not being cool being in MI5, no.
What was uncool about being in MI5?
Well, despite what they're trying to make out, you know, it's all this sort of shagging Uber babes and, you know, drinking cocktails, it's actually very boring. You sit behind a desk and you direct operations. So essentially, you're a bureaucrat. You do occasionally go out and do exciting stuff. But in fact, it's really not that exciting. Sitting in a car doing surveillance can be like 6 hours of nothing going on. It's really tedious. And listening to people's conversations, you know, on their phone calls and stuff, is not interesting from a security point of view. It's only interesting for the drama of people's lives. You know? No, but I think that is important, though, because you actually do learn when you hear these so-called terrorists speaking on the phone. You realise they're family people and so on. They're not psychopaths. And particularly people like the IRA had an understanding of what they saw as a legitimate target, you know, the British Army or whatever, and they would not kill civilians, you know.
Yes, well, Big Brother addicts might disagree with you that listening to people's boring conversations is a waste of time and not a form of entertainment. Arthur, is it cool wielding the sword of Excalibur?
Yeah, it's good to be the king. And I am an official sword bearer, so I do wield the sword of Britain, which is the pagan sword of Britain, which is Excalibur. And yes, but it has with it certain responsibilities. And as I've always said, and I've been arrested for that sword many times, and as I've always said, if I was chasing someone down the street with a sword, I'd want me nicked. The reality is it stays in a scabbard. It comes out for ceremony and ritual only. And it's been quite interesting over years arguing the point in law, because of course a lot of the judges I've been arguing it with are themselves members of, shall we say, Masonic lodges that have sword bearers as well. So it's an interesting point in law, although as a druid I will quote some of the some of the laws that they're not aware of, some of the more ancient law, and that's intellectually challenging in court. So yeah, it's good to be the king.
Yes, and I can imagine the judges respect the fact that you might know something they don't, or that the because if that's their profession, that's their passion often, and if that's their passion, they respect somebody else knowing about it.
That's right, and a lot of the judges themselves will know the history, and they will know that the ancient druids were the lawgivers and the lawmakers of their time, as well as being the priest caste. And a lot of the judges will stand there, and they'll be in their robes, and they'll know the history of their robes come from my robes, and they will know the history. And they, when faced with a druid, a bona fide druid who they recognise as a druid, they will show respect. I mean, interestingly enough, very recently, Royal Courts of Justice, I asked for right of address as a Mackenzie friend, which is a lay advisor. The judge gave me right of address. He said, only one problem, how do I address you? I said, actually, it's Reverend King, my lord. He referred to me for the rest of the proceedings as Reverend.
So, could you tell us the synchronous story about how you found the sword? Or how you acquired the sword?
I could, but I'm not going to read the book. That's not what this interview's about. It's not so what makes me think I'm Arthur. It's what does Arthur do? Arthur's got the sword, and it's what Arthur does with it that counts, not how he got it. But how I got it, in brief, the magic provided. But there's a whole other story there that I really don't want to go into at the moment.
Fair point, well made. The book is The Trials of Arthur, The Life and Times of a Modern Day King.
And by it's also out of print.
It's also out of print, but you can find one if you try hard enough. By Arthur Pendragon and Christopher James Stone. So, spiritual revelations. We got there eventually, David.
Yes, indeed, yes.
Tell us more about the Kabbalah and how you discovered spirituality.
Well, it's really strange how once you take this kind of spiritual jump, you realise that it's not really what happens to you, it's how you react to it. And even before I'd taken the spiritual leap, they clearly tried to mess me up because we had to submit a book to them. We couldn't get it out, otherwise they'd just put me in prison again, so we needed their permission. And they wouldn't actually ban it, they just said we haven't given permission yet. So for this one, for 15 months, and in that time, I was looking for something to do, and I just started reading loads of esoteric stuff. And by reading esoteric stuff, I saw lots of mentions of Kabbalah. And so I thought I'd have a look at this. And I've always been somebody who's been open to ideas, basically. The reason I've never been interested in religion or spirituality before is I'd read too much sort of New Age bollocks stuff and not enough real stuff, you know. And it was just, I think, the time in my life as well, because I say I was trapped in fear and anger, I really needed something else at that point. And it worked. I mean, the thing about Kabbalah is it starts off not by saying you must believe this set of rigid rules. It says exactly the opposite. It says that you must you know, don't believe what we're saying, go and test it for yourself. So I did, and it seemed to work. It seemed that suddenly by doing positive thought and meditation, I could in some small way change the world. What I find fascinating about this is just how far does it go? And I've got to tell you the story about the UEFA Cup final, because I feel as if this is part of my kind of mission to get this off my chest. And all I can say to people, I will tell people the facts of this story. And all I can say to them is that they can take it as they wish, basically. But I have to explain that Middlesbrough are not a particularly fashionable club. Then a club that in the past would crumple with a change in atmospheric pressure. You know, they just had no backbone or anything. So they had very loyal fans, but it never seemed to quite take off, basically. And this began at the beginning. It began at the end of the 2004-2005 season. At the last game of the season, Middlesbrough playing at Man City. They've got to draw to get into UEFA Cup. And all the other games that season are finished. They go to the City of Manchester Stadium. It's one each. I think it's going to be all over. And they say, no, we've got a last-minute penalty in Man City. And this is one of the first examples I had of this, where not even thinking about it, I almost subconsciously went into the meditative state for absolute certainty this goal wasn't going to go in the back of the net, and the keeper saved it. And I was slightly kind of like, woo, that's a bit. But then you think it's just coincidence, whatever. But then I went to the... I was watching the second leg on television in the last 16. So we're playing way above our normal standards here. Playing away in Rome. We went 1-0 up, but then we had all this kind of evil eye stuff. They scored a very dodgy goal, a very dodgy penalty given against us. And there was 30 minutes of them bombarding our goal, but at the same time, I was doing absolute certainty they weren't going to score, and they didn't. So this is like another part of the picture, but nothing conclusive. Where it gets really interesting is in the quarterfinals, where we're 2-0 down off the first leg. I go to the game, so I'm actually there. Within 20 minutes, we've gone 3-0 down. So this means we have to score four goals under the away goals rule to go through. I can't remember Middlesbrough ever came back from two down before. I just thought, this is it. I'm going to kind of make my something I believe happens. I mean, if this really does happen, let's do this. Let's see this as an opportunity to really think positive thought can work. And I went into this meditation mainly for unconditional love, and so I was tapping into 30 years of unconditional love for my football team, which is quite, you know, strange, but that was there. And obviously tapping into the positive thought of 30,000 other people. But just in the past, what we hadn't done was connect to the light. And this is where we connect to the light. And there was just this terrible inevitability about it in this particular game. The Middlesbrough surged forward time and time again. And eventually, in the last minute, we scored and we won 4-3. And I actually touched the light. Reality pixelated. I went to white light, then reality pixelated back again. Only for a few seconds. That was a miracle enough, I thought. But then,
ladies and gentlemen, I'd just like to reiterate that this was football and not mescaline.
and well, it was, but this is it. I mean, I've, you know, obviously experimented, shall we say, with consciousness and the effects of various chemicals on consciousness. And this was, you know, I, in the past, when people said to me, "Oh, you can get higher without drugs," I never believed that. And I now come to the conclusion that in some ways you can get higher without drugs. You get into that trance-like state. It really is like nothing else. But the thing about this interesting story is that it gets more interesting, because in the semi-finals, we're only 1-0 down for the first leg, and so everybody thinks, oh, we've got a good chance. I go up to the game, and of course, they score twice in the first 20 minutes. So we're 3-0 down after the 20 minutes of the second leg. And this was the real test, and I thought, let's try and do it again. And I did it for unconditional love, for miracle making, and it wasn't really working. And suddenly, from nowhere, I got this idea that we were being had the evil eye put on us. So I started to remove the evil eye, and within a minute of doing this, we scored, which just absolutely hit me. And as a former rationalist, it was like, you know, I kind of believe I'm doing this, but I don't want to believe this. It's just too much, you know. It's like you're shown the light, and it's almost too scary to even go there. But even then, I kind of carry on doing this, and I went to got to three each about 5 minutes later. We had a long time to score the fourth goal, and at one point it really didn't look like it was coming. They got back into the game. And so it was, again, quite heavy meditation, thinking, I've got to believe, sort of thing. And lo and behold, in the last minute we scored again, 4-3. And at that point I kind of blacked out. I don't really know what happened. I went somewhere else. Came back to the ground, sort of, there I am cheering. And at this moment, the Middlesbrough fans start cheering, E-I-O, E-I-O, E-I-O. Which is a Kabbalistic chant. It's the name of one of the names of God. And it's the name of God for great expectations. And the Middlesbrough fans have done this for years. And of course, I didn't know this before I got into Kabbalah.
Right, I've heard EIL somewhere before.
It's the Druidic chant as well, of course. Yeah, yeah. And that's what I find, you know, supposed to be the sound of the spheres, interesting enough. So in this moment where I've just come down for this meditation, where we've won this thing again, and I hear the Middlesbrough crowd chanting the Kabbalistic chant or the Druidic chant without even knowing what they're doing. It's the kind of whole mental thing about the light and everything. And the next day after this, I really just, I was kind of numb. I couldn't really express myself. It was like the whole universe had seismically shifted, that this was possible. I'd been shown that I could perform miracles through positive thought as long as I have the light. And then you think, well, you can translate that to so much. So my life has now completely changed. And of course, the question people will say is, well, why didn't you win the final? Because I went to the final, I arrived too early, and I got drunk, and alcohol cuts out the light, basically. That's the final bit. But fortunately, because of Kabbalah, I have no guilt either.
You heard it here first. MI5, football, the fix is in.
Thank you, Sarah. I don't know where to begin after that. Well, yeah, I'm glad you did reveal that story to us now, actually. Okay, if you have a single message about Stonehenge or Britain's trees, what is it?
If I have a single message about Stonehenge or Britain's trees, it's save them and use them. Don't abuse them.
Short but simple, and usually the most powerful sentiments.
I do sound bites. Yeah. Remember, I'm the druid that kicks ass. I'm not the druid that gets up there and waffles for 3 hours and there's a point to it.
I meant you do short and simple.
Yes, we also have present another loyal Arthurian war battle chieftain, warband battle chieftain, Susanna, the only female battle chieftain within the loyal Arthurian warband, and she's cheeky to the king on a frequent basis. And David, if you have a single message about 9/11, what is it?
This is a great opportunity to change the world, basically. We shouldn't get depressed by this. You should see it exactly opposite. It's so easy to expose this. We can do that, and we can create a change in consciousness, because everybody thinks they know about 9/11. When they realise they've been lied to, they'll realise they've been lied to about a lot of other things.
Anna, Susanna, have you got any thing you'd like to add to the discussion?
I opened the book in my lap at this point, and I opened it out. After that, things started to get really strange. Tim Sebastian, who you now know as the Archdruid of the Secular Order of Druids, came out very agitated. "I've had it with your fucking warband," he said to Arthur. "Orc has just gone off with my tobacco." He was so angry that he took his staff, which had a crescent moon on the top, laid it on a step and stamped on it. It broke with a healthy sounding crack. The joke here is that Tim regularly breaks his staff and then bandages it up with a pink scarf in between. So he wasn't really breaking his staff, he was making a dramatic gesture.
That's what I love about Druidry, the theatre. Yes, well, I would like to say thank you very much, David, and thank you very much, King Arthur Pendragon.
It's been a pleasure.
Yes, thank you very much.
It's been a pleasure, hasn't it?
Thank you.